accession number 4588, reel 5.
Mrs. Burkell, tape 5. Mrs. Burkell, you said before that the War Office was much more difficult than the Home Office.
Yes.
You just made that statement. Could you elaborate a little on that, please?
Well, you see, to the war, to the Home Office, the refugees were, on the whole, respectable, normal people who had to escape their country, and they would help as much as possible. Whilst the War Office, to them, they were simply enemy aliens. The war was on, and that was that, and the sooner one could put them away and have them safe, the better.
So really it was a difference of attitude, perception.
It was really the different attitude of two absolutely different departments. I would like to say something about the Home Office, if I may, at the moment. There were, during the time that we were working, there were two absolutely outstanding people in the Home Office. One was Sir Alexander Maxwell, and the other one was Sir Alexander
Patterson.
Yes. Sir Alexander Maxwell was quite astonishing. If you wrote him a letter and put personal on it, he would not allow any of his secretariat to open it. He put complete trust in you. I had very difficult positions at different times. For example, I had a Polish widow with 4 boys. The boys were in the Jewish free school in Ely. The eldest boy became 14 and wanted to go into motor mechanics. He was an alien. He could not go into motor mechanics. But this woman's husband, quite accidentally, was born in Britain. So she and her husband were British. And that is why this poor, completely uneducated woman was sent out of Europe to England as the war started. She couldn't leave her 4 small children, so the English passport officer said, put them on your passport. That's all right. But of course, when they became a work age, they were aliens. Now, this was a very difficult position. And I wrote to Sir Alexander Maxwell pointing out this situation. And he had a great game with me. He had never met me, but he must have found out that I was very easy to tease. So he waited till the boy's 14th birthday and then phoned me up at my office and said, it's all right, Mrs. Burkill, I've naturalized the whole lot. And that was in the middle of the war. And every time I had this sort of difficulty, I had a research student at Sydney, Sussex, who was a physicist and who was German. His parents and his brothers were living in Bristol. The university wanted him to unpack some atomic material which had never been unpacked since war began. But, of course, he was an alien. He couldn't do it. So again, I wrote Sir Alexander Maxwell and the boy was just going to be 21. And I was in a terrible nervous state about it. But he waited till the boy's 21st birthday, rang me up and said, "I've naturalized the whole damn family." And always, whenever I asked him, though he had never met me, he had his little joke, but he did what I asked him to do. And that, for a busy head of the Home Office, was quite astounding. Now, Patterson was his second in command at the Home Office. He was the head of the Czech Refugee Committee. We, of course, had Czech children. The Czechs, fortunately, had money in this country, so one was in an easier position. But after the war, the question came whether the Czech children should join their parents. Sir Alexander would come up over and over again, driving from London to Cambridge, to discuss the welfare of a Czech child. I had one Czech girl who didn't want to go back. She was very happy in her home, but he felt she should go back. But he made me the promise that she would have a passport, that she could return, and there would be the money for her to return. This was impossible with the Central European children, who a great many were very unhappy when they were returned.
Yes, I want to follow that up later. That's something I very much want to ask you about. Could I just ask you, please, Mrs. Burkhill, you said the Czech children had money in the country.
Well, there was a whole lot of money which belonged to the Czech government.
This would be the Czech government in exile.
Yes.
I see.
But whatever money there was, which belonged to the Czech government, whilst they were, the Czech government in exile, was their money. You know, I had the same sort of thing about Nigerian money, which doesn't do with this case, but when there was the war in Nigeria, I had a great many of the
The two different groups, yes.
And I was very worried how they would support themselves. The university said we will not charge them, and we were assured that all the money would come from the Nigerian oil to pay all their bills. So none of these boys and girls who were in the university and the tech here, they were all safeguarded.
Yes. Going back to your Czech children, you know, the refugees, the earlier ones, were the Polish children in the same situation? Was there money, Polish money in England?
I don't think we had any Polish money.
No. I'm so
no, I don't think we had any Polish money. And we didn't have many Polish children. We had a certain number of Hungarian children. We had a great many Czech children.
When did the Czech children come out?
Well, the same time, you see. Germany had walked into Czechoslovakia, you see, in 37, wasn't it?
Yes, and they started coming over then.
They came in. They hadn't walked into Poland until war was declared. Therefore, we didn't have any Polish children. We had a very few Hungarian children, but I mean, infinitesimal. But we had, of course, the real... Wales was Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia.
Thank you. Could I now ask you some more details about Bloomsbury House? Because previously you explained how they were coping with this great influx of children, the 10,000 that came over after Kristallnacht. And the impression one gets is of a very chaotic situation at that time. Could you tell me something about their organisation?
Well, what happened? You see, there were two classes of children, the guaranteed children and the unguaranteed.
Yes, you have explained that very well, actually,
yes,
before.
You're happy about that.
Yes, it is really how Bloomsbury House was organised. Do you think they were particularly efficient yourself?
Oh, no, completely inefficient. Mm. You see, that was the real disaster, that the Home Office gave us Bloomsbury House as an office for all the different departments. It had been a hotel. But they didn't give them any managerial help. They didn't give them any Home Office civil servants who could tell them how to run a big sudden affair like that, because it wasn't only the movement, you see, it was the whole enormous influx of people.
Yes, which you have explained so well.
And you see, that was the difficulty, that all the work to begin with was voluntary work, and people came at different times, and so files became all muddled. Because somebody dealt with a file on Monday and somebody else tried to deal with the same file on Tuesday.
Did they not have any full-time staff at all there?
They had no trained staff. It was simply... I mean, ultimately, of course, they got refugees who had been trained secretaries and so on, whom they took on. But it was... I mean, this was so frustrating for the regions, because they had all their work completely tableized, tidy. And then it had to go to Bloomsbury House, where it got muddled. And you felt that a child or a grown-up was in great danger, and you could do nothing, because everything had to go through Bloomsbury House. Well, they learned ultimately, but it took a long time.
And did you find that this really did delay cases?
Oh, yes, it delayed cases enormously. And, of course, the anxiety that the people suffered who hoped to come out and never knew whether they would make it, well, was terrific. The work, we in the different regions got letters asking for help. We had to decide whether the case was an urgent case or not, which put a great responsibility on us. And I think we all suffered emotionally from this. Once we had decided that we should help a particular person, we then sent all the particulars to Bloomsbury House, which was the head office dealing with all refugee questions. Bloomsbury House then would prepare their file on this particular person. But unfortunately, Bloomsbury House, at the time when it was most needed, had no secretarial know-how. It was run by voluntary labor who came on different days, and files were apt to be lost. And files being lost might mean somebody's life. From Bloomsbury House, the files had to go to the Home Office for the Home Office to agree to have this particular person in Great Britain. from the Home Office, it was then sent to the religious committee of that particular person, which might be the Jewish Kultusgemeinde, the Archbishop's Catholic Committee, or the Church of England Committee in Germany, or wherever it was. They then visited the person and made sure that our judgment was right. If they agreed, they would then have to send it to the German official committees to allow this person, who was most likely Jewish or half Jewish, to be allowed to leave the country. Then, of course, the person who would get permission to leave the country would have to make a statement about his finances, what he would be allowed to take out. And of course, at the very end, before the war, they were only allowed to take out a certain amount of their possessions and 10 marks a person, which would not get you very far. So when they arrived in England, they were completely at the financial mercy of their British guarantor or the government. Yes.
This sounds a very lengthy process. Could you give me some idea as to the sort of quickest case you ever got out, and the average, and perhaps the slowest?
I find that very difficult.
Was it a matter of sort of weeks or months, do you think?
Well, I should say, let us say, I mean, I wouldn't vouch for it, but let us say that it would take 6 to 8 weeks. There was sometimes we had children about whom we were very anxious, because they were in a small German town and were the only Jewish family in this town, and the Kultusgemeinde of the bigger towns were not particularly interested in them, because one suspects they were not very religious Jews. But Dr. Loi used to have visits from Rabbi Leo Beck, who was a very famous Jewish theologian and who was allowed to travel. And whenever I had a very worrying case, Dr. Loi always brought Rabbi Beck to me, and I would tell him the particular children I was worried about. And I got those out much quicker than any other child, because he would then really get going. And I was always very grateful to Dr. Loi that he made it possible for me to get these completely lost children out of Germany.
Could I ask you something about the trade union attitudes? You said earlier on that the trade unions felt under threat,
yes,
from the young people, you know, when they became of working age in England.
Of course, during the 30s, as everybody remembers, the labour situation in Great Britain was very difficult, and there was very heavy unemployment. The Home Office had to go very gently in allowing these unaccompanied children to come to this country, who would compete with work, with the English working men's children. For the first 3 or 4 months, we were allowed to bring in children up to the age of 18, which we were, of course, very keen to do, because the older child was in far greater danger to be put in concentration camp than the younger child, and boys were in greater danger than girls.
Would it be right to say it was your policy then to sort of try and bring the older ones
in the earlier days? I mean, it certainly was a policy in my region. See, I can always only talk of my region, because there I, so to speak, dictated the policy, whatever Bloomsbury House said.
Yes, I understand.
And that is what, of course, made Bloomsbury House rather cross. But, I mean, that was our system. But very soon, the trade unions got very worried about this. And an ukas went out that we were not allowed to bring in any child over 15, which of course meant that these children were in danger.
Did the trade unions realize that, do you think? Did they understand what the situation was in Central Europe?
No, I don't really think. You see, to the ordinary working class people, these children were just German children. They had no idea about Judaism, about persecution or anything. And one must realize that. And one must realize how generously they behaved to these children when they didn't have the background of understanding that we did have. Which, you know, but then, as I say, we were allowed to bring in boys between 15 and 18 as trainees. The law put down was that for every refugee child that came into the country, £50 had to be deposited in the bank, so that if Great Britain felt at any moment they must evacuate refugee children, there would be money to pay their fare. This actually, the £50 never changed hands. Because the movement were the greatest benefactors of the Baldwin Fund. And the Baldwin Fund put out the £50 for each child. But for the trainee, you had to find £100, which in 38 was a lot of money. You had to ensure that the boy or girl would get a proper training. You had to assure that the boy or girl would be paid by his employer £3 a week. So you can see, to persuade people to take a boy or girl as a trainee was very hard work. I did manage it. After all, Cambridge has many colleges. And of course, I always started with a college that was most friendly to me. And I got a whole lot of refugee boys into college kitchens as trainee cooks, where I could be assured. And then from there, when I had exhausted all the colleges who liked me, I shamed the rest of the colleges in taking trainee cooks. And so I was, and was really in a fortunate position that I could get out some of the most endangered boys. And of course I got a few into agriculture by farmers whom I knew. But my main outlet was the college kitchens.
Could I ask you now about the special difficulties experienced by the refugees?
The difficulties
they had, the sort of psychological, emotional
yes,
difficulties.
Yes, now this of course is very important. There is a tremendous division between the guaranteed child and the unguaranteed child. You see, the guaranteed child would go in a prepared home where the people were expecting the child lovingly and would do their utmost to put it at ease. We had, of course, certain cases of unhappiness. You see, what we said in Cambridge, when we brought in about 70 odd children, we said to every guarantor, if you find you are unhappy with the child, we will take the child into our home. And one or two, it did happen that we just added to our family. That was Sybil Hutton and I. But on the whole, as far as I know, it worked very successfully. But now the unguaranteed child, who was of course the child in the greatest danger, was brought over in large numbers. And they were put into a camp near Dover, which was windy and cold, and people used to come and pick children, and the children found this very difficult to accept. And that created a very great emotional upset. But what, and now and again you get letters in the Jewish newspapers, people saying how unhappy and badly treated they were when they came over. But what people are forgetting, that these children who were unguaranteed came from already extremely insecure surroundings in their home country, from a secure, assured home. They found their parents were lying, their parents didn't know where to turn, there was emotional difficulties at home. Then they were torn from a surrounding they knew. They weren't allowed to go to school. Everything was against them. And then they came into this camp without, where everybody was trying to do their best, but it was mass production. And they were all settled as quickly as possible in homes, in security. But it left a jar, a scar really on their minds. But I always feel that if they hadn't come over already as disturbed children, there wouldn't have been a scar.
Yes, I think what I'm trying to find out as well, all that you say is very interesting and explains a great deal, but how many of them were psychologically disturbed, these children? Because after all, as you say, they had very bad backgrounds in Germany, most unsettled backgrounds. And I was wondering how their problems sort of manifested themselves? Did, for instance, they wet the bed at night? Did you have any problems in that respect?
We had, of course, certain psychological difficulties. I mean, of course, we had a girl who had obviously menstrual difficulties and wouldn't tell the family she lived with, you know, and she was very intelligent and she was at the Perche, but she just couldn't talk to the people about it, and that was very difficult. What was very interesting was if we brought in two or three children of the same family, that the eldest child could never settle down in the same way as the younger children. This was, I mean, so the love poured on the children was exactly the same. They never spoke English without an accent, whilst the other children took to English like duck to water. And I put this down, that when they were with their parents, the parents discussed the problem with the oldest child, and everybody tried to protect the younger children. And that the oldest child really carried a very great weight by the time it came to this country. And that we found in Cambridge amongst our guaranteed children over and over again.